hand's gonna get tired.
You're already complaining about the weight of the microphone. Cute.
It's very heavy.
Dad, Blaze Boshin, welcome to V the People. Did you know that was the name of my podcast?
Yes, I did.
How are you feeling? Are you nervous?
A little bit. This is a little strange.
Why?
Because I'm talking to my daughter through a microphone.
Yeah, but this is cool. I'm glad that I'm going to have this forever.
Okay.
All right, so I have a lot of questions, but I want to introduce you to the listeners. I wanted to have you on the podcast, well, A, because you're my favorite man, and you know I'm kind of a man-hater, so that's a big compliment.
Well, thank you.
And also, you've had a very rich life. You've had a lot that's gone on in your life, so I wanted to ask you about it.
Yeah, many experiences.
So you grew up as the seventh of nine children.
That's correct.
What did it feel like to be the seventh? Did you feel like you got lost in the shuffle at all, or was it more of like a built-in community?
Yeah, I didn't really know any different, you know, being the seventh of nine. That was my normal, you know. I don't really remember the other two, my two younger brothers as babies or anything. It was just, you know, it was just always a big family and always doing things with everyone, having a good time. You know, that was my normal. I didn't know any different.
Do you feel like you took on a role like peacemaker, observer, or troublemaker?
No, that the peacemaker was more Joe, the oldest. Mm-hmm. You know, he would always control everybody. Me being one of the younger ones, you know, I really couldn't cause too much trouble because as soon as I would try, they would put me in my place, you know. So it was like, hey, you're one of the young ones, knock it off, you know, behave yourself. So didn't really feel like I had a role in the family.
Okay. You kind of just followed orders.
Yes. Yep.
I feel like I've heard so many of the stories just from my upbringing, but what would you say was like the most trouble that you guys got? And I say guys because it was eight boys, one girl. What would you say was like the most trouble that you guys got into together? That you're allowed to say on air.
Well, when my grandfather built the house for my parents, it was the only house on the whole block. And the field next to it, we used to play firefighter. We would set the field on fire and then put it out. And one time the wind whipped up and it got out of control and the fire company had to come to put the fire out. So
how would you put it out?
With the hose and buckets of water. We'd have the buckets of water ready and have the hose ready. And, you know, once it got to a certain point, we'd go, okay, here we go. We're going to put it out now. And that time before we could put it out, the whole field was up.
How would you start the fire?
Matches and gas.
Oh, my God. I didn't know you used gasoline.
Sure. How else are you going to start the field on fire?
How many times did you do it before that time?
Oh, 10 to 20.
And it was all of you together?
Well, there'd be a group of us. It wouldn't be everybody all at once, but it would be like, hey, we're bored today. Let's play firefighter. Let's set the field on fire. So, you know.
You were playing pretend, happen. But not really.
Correct.
And did you take turns lighting the field?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And it was Eddie that time.
Yes. Eddie is the one who started that one, happened to start that one. And, you know, we all ran away when we heard the sirens coming. We're like, okay, let's get out of here.
I remember Uncle Eddie telling that story a lot.
Yep.
What was dinner like?
Again, you know, being one of the younger ones, I'm sure Joe experienced, you know, the addition of each sibling to the dinner table. But, you know, all I ever knew was, hey, the table was filled with people. And there was always enough food for all of us. What you put on your plate, you had to eat. And, you know, you could always go back for more. But the rule was, if you take too much and put it on your plate, well, the next time mom and dad were going to fill your plate if you didn't eat everything that you took. So you made sure that, you know, you took what you thought you could eat. And again, if there was left on a on the table, you could take more, you know?
I also want to set the scene for everyone that this, how, what would you say was the square footage of this house?
Oh, well, there were two rooms upstairs. It was a very small, you want to call it a Cape Cod, but
yeah,
it had no windows to the front or rear of the house upstairs, just one window at each end wall upstairs. And the walls came up about 3 feet and then started to angle to the ceiling. Well, the eight boys occupied those two rooms upstairs. There was a double bed and two single beds upstairs in each room. So you rotated through. So sometimes you were sleeping with one of your brothers. And then sometimes you had a single bed. So it was quite crowded up there.
One bathroom.
And one full bathroom. And there was an extra toilet downstairs in the basement. So if it got crowded, you'd have to go down there.
What would Mama make for dinner a lot?
There were casseroles. A lot of casseroles, but a lot of Polish food, hams. You know, ham went a long way. Now, my dad was business partners with a butcher. They owned racehorses. Mm-hmm. So, and he also owned two bars in the city of Reading. So a lot of the things that we would get would be at wholesale prices. Mm-hmm. And being partners with a butcher, the butcher, you know, gave them deals on meats and everything. I didn't know this as a child growing up, but we would have T-bone steaks every other week or so. And, you know, as I became an adult, I realized that, you know, talking to my friends and everything, people were like, "You had steak that often?"
Yeah.
You know, I just, again, that was my normal because of, you know, my father's connections with people. And, you know, we weren't rich by any stretch of the imagination, but we weren't destitute. You know,
yeah.
We always had food to eat and, you know, enjoyed life.
Yeah. What were some of like the top, I would say, three non-negotiable rules in your house?
Yeah, keep your hands off of other people's clothes, money.
Okay.
And do your chores. You know, everybody had jobs to do and you did your chores and, you know, you helped out.
What do you think you learned about people just by having so many siblings?
Just how to communicate and not be afraid to talk to people. My dad always used to say, there's two types of people in this world. There's good people and bad people.
Mm-hmm.
He used the term a-holes, you know.
You're allowed to curse.
So he would say, you know, there's assholes and there's good people. And your job is to let them show you which one they are. Don't prejudge them. Again, that was, you know, he owned businesses and you didn't, when a customer walked in the door, you didn't prejudge the customer. You know, they're people and let them show you whether they're good or not. You know, there was a black man who sat at the end of the bar. His name was Richie. And everybody called him Uncle Richie. I was a teenager before my brothers told me, you know, he's really not your uncle. But I was like, no, that's my Uncle Richie. You know, that's what we call him. And that's what he was like, everyone's uncle. So, you know, it, again, to me, it didn't matter, you know, what you looked like, what you sounded like. It was how you treated people and how you acted.
Yeah.
You know, whether you were good or not. So.
Yeah. Okay, so... was it right after high school? I actually realized I don't know the answer to this, that you joined the Navy?
No, right out of high school. Again, one of my dad's bits of wisdom. I was very immature when I graduated high school. I graduated at 17, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So he said, hey, you can live at the house as long as you want. You can live there rent-free if you get a job. If you don't get a job, you're going to pay me rent. Mm. So that was his way of saying you're not going to be a freeloader.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a job as an accounting clerk for an insurance company in the city of Reading. I started on July 1st on a Friday. because my boss said, if you start on Friday, July 1st, you'll get Monday off as a paid holiday. I was like, okay, that makes sense. You know, work one day, get the next day off as a paid holiday. And I worked there for 7 months. Okay. But after, as it was approaching Christmas, you know, I was still hanging out with some of the kids in the neighborhood that were still in high school. And I sort of just felt a little like, okay, I got to do something. I got to do something with my life and get out of here. So that's when I started to, two of my older brothers had been in the service. They were both in the Navy. My father was in the Navy. So I thought, well, let me go see, you know, about joining the military. So I went and talked to the recruiter, and I worked at that insurance company from July through the end of January. And then the middle of February, I left for the Navy.
What did that, where did you go?
I went to Great Lakes Training Center, which is about half an hour north of Chicago.
Oh, wow.
Went through boot camp there, and then went through electronics school there, electronics technician school. So we would go down into Chicago for different events. The great thing about being in the service, most of the bases have a USO office, and you'd go there and just ask, you know, what they had for free. We went to see a Chicago Bears game. We went to Chicago Cubs games. Cool. We went to concerts. I saw Bob Dylan one weekend at Chicago Bulls Arena, and the following weekend I saw the Beach Boys.
What?
So two totally different audiences, you know, but great experiences nonetheless. In the summertime, we got tickets. We saw Kris Kristofferson and Rita Coolidge in concert together at Ravinia Park.
For free.
For free, through the USO.
Dad, I never knew this.
Sure. We went up to Milwaukee, which was, you know, just over the border into Wisconsin. We had tickets there to see baseball games. I saw a Green Bay Packers game up there. You know, we were always going to the USO saying, okay, what do you have, you know, freebies?
How long were you there?
I was there from February until Thanksgiving Eve.
Oh, that's
we graduated.
A long time.
We graduated Thanksgiving Eve from school and got shipped out. So I was able to come home for Thanksgiving before I was transferring down to Orlando, Florida for nuclear power school.
Couple of questions. Were you scared to go to boot camp?
No, my older brothers had told me, you know, their experiences in boot camp. In movies, you hear all these horror stories and you see these, you know, glamorized or non-glamorized versions of the drill sergeants and everything. They put you through the ringer because they're trying to test your mental capacity to make sure that you're not going to crack under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, you know, they're not out to hurt anyone. You know, they're just trying to instill the military discipline in you that you're going to need to obey orders, you know.
And do you pick a track there as far as, like, the fact that you ended up taking the nuclear route?
So before you go in, you take a test. It's called the ASVAB test. And based on the scores you get there, they offer you different things. I knew I was guaranteed the nuclear power program, but there are three specialties that go into that: an electronics technician, an electrician's mate, and a machinist mate. So the electronics technician was my first choice, but you really don't know which of the three you're going to get. I knew I was going to be in a nuclear power program, but didn't know which of those three.
And you knew that based on how you did on the test?
On the test, yes.
Did you get really good grades in high school?
I was capable of good grades, but the first grading session, I would always do well, and then it would tail off throughout the year because I was having more fun than schooling.
But your brain is wired to be very mathematical.
Yes.
So yes. You took, what did you end up getting of those three positions?
The electronics technician.
Okay.
Which in the nuclear power program, everyone considers that to be the top category.
Okay, so top in the nuclear power program, fast forward how many years later, trying to teach your creative daughter math at the kitchen table.
Oh.
No, I wasn't asking you to comment on it. I was just saying it's ironic.
Yes.
Please don't comment. I'm just kidding. Okay, so when you went to Orlando, is that when you first went on the submarine or no?
No. Orlando, at that point in time, that's where the nuclear power school was. So I went down there, got there in December. But it's really funny because the nuclear power school was so backlogged with students trying to start school that I was basically sent to Orlando and given a 6-month temporary assignment working as a clerk in an office in the officer's side of the nuclear power school to wait for my class to start.
Okay.
My class didn't actually start until like May or June. So I spent 5 or 6 months in Orlando just waiting for school to start. Again, you're just hanging out during the day, and then at night you have no real duties or anything. So we're all just goofing around, playing sports, going out, you know, again, going to the USO. What tickets do you have available? I must have gone to Disney in Orlando every other weekend for free.
Wow.
You know, for months. You know, there was a group of us that would be like, okay, what are we doing this weekend? Hey, let's go get tickets and just walk around Disney, go on some rides. And, you know, when we'd get bored, we'd leave.
So at this point, were you only like 18 or 19?
I was 18.
Wow.
No, 19 in Florida, because I graduated 17, turned 18 in November, went in the military. So when I left the Great Lakes area, I had just turned 19 and then spent 19 through 20.
So you couldn't drink that whole time that you were in Orlando?
On the military base, you can.
What?
At 18, when you're in the military on the base, you're allowed to drink. So
how does that make any sense?
I could drink alcohol. I could drink beer. I couldn't drink hard liquor. So they have rules on the base that you could drink. They call it 3.2 beer. You could drink beer that contain less than 3.2 and less percent alcohol. So you were drinking like light beers and things like that. You weren't drinking the Molson XX and stuff that was like 5-6% alcohol.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get hard liquor either.
Wow.
But so at least you could have a drink.
Okay, so once you started school, how long was that program?
That was 6 months. So we did 6 months of it was just completely in-class training, but you learn everything about a nuclear power plant, the chemistry, the physics, and all the controls that go along with it, all the safeguards that the Navy put into place.
Did you like it?
It was quite interesting.
Was it hard?
Oh, very hard. You go through 6 months of training. And you're tested the entire time, so you have to pass the test. There were people that flunked out, and the last thing that happened, you had a 400-question test.
Holy shit.
400-question final. And you had to get 250 questions correct, and it was a 4 or 5-hour test.
How many did you get right?
I don't know. All they told you was whether you passed or failed.
Oh, wow.
And if you failed, you went before review board for them to figure out why you failed, you know, and what you were going to do after that. So they just told you whether you passed or failed. And that test was on a Monday. And on Sunday, we were all of our training materials were classified. So you did all your homework and all your studying and everything in the building.
Okay.
You had a locker where you locked everything up.
Because it's, were there like government secrets in there?
Classified material about the nuclear power.
So you, plants. Do you still keep all that tied up here?
Oh, sure.
But you know certain things?
Right.
Have you ever told mom?
Well, there's general things that you can, you can compare it to the nuclear power industry that's available commercially. It's just, you know, the way the military ran it versus a commercial power plant here.
Wow.
You know, it's just a little different.
That's exciting. So, I'm sorry, Sunday night before your test, you were all...
Well, it was during the day. We were all there and we're studying and studying. We were studying all weekend. And I just said to everybody, like, it was like 11 o'clock in the morning. I said, I'm burnt out. I can't do this anymore. If I stay here all day, tomorrow, I'm just going to be, you know...
A zombie.
taking this test. I'm like, I'm going to the beach. We were an hour away from Daytona. I said, I'm going to Daytona. I'm going to hang out. Just, you know, you could park your car on the beach. You could drive on the beach. So we were going there. We got up to leave. A couple guys said, okay, I'm going with you. We got up to leave and we put our books away and we looked at each other and went, we can't do this. We got to go back and study. We walked back in the room, sat down another half hour. I was like, no, I'm done. I'm really done. Let's go. So we packed up. We went to Daytona for the day and just relaxed. And we were probably the sharpest people the next day taking that test. Everybody else, like you said, they were like zombies. And we were just, you know, looking at each other going, man, I feel good. You know, we just
got some sun.
We chilled out. You know?
R&R.
Yeah. So
what a great life lesson.
Yeah. And then we left there right before Christmas. And from there, I went up to the Saratoga Springs, New York, Boston Spa. They have a base up there that has working nuclear power plants. And that's where you complete your training to actually work on replica vessels of the Navy. So there was a partial submarine. There was a destroyer inside this big giant concrete ball. It was the D1G ball, Destroyer 1 General Electric. I was on the S3G submarine, third generation GE power plant.
But they're replicas.
They're working. Yeah, when I say replica, they're partial ships and boats that they have the power plant in them, but you're walking through hatches. So it's basically like you're on a military ship running the power plant.
Cool.
And it's built to scale. It is the operating power plant that you would be working on in a submarine or on a destroyer.
And that's how you finish your program.
And that's how you finish your program. You actually work on the power plant. You learn all the systems. And then you test there. Again, it's a review board of three or four people that are asking you questions about any and every system in the power plant. So even though I was an electronics technician, I have to know the mechanical side of the plant. I have to know the electrical side of the plant, any electronic side of the plant.
Wow.
So they ask you questions about everything. Because in an emergency, you have to make sure that the plant stays safe.
As an aside, this is obviously pre-cell phone. So like,
oh yes.
Are you just writing home? Like, do mama and pop, do your brothers know that you're like climbing and doing this well?
Sure. Snail mail.
Yep.
Lots of letters. Well, as you know, one of the things that Sue did, my wife, your mother, after my oldest brother and his wife have now both passed away, when they were cleaning out the house, Zach brought home the letters that people were just going to throw away. And they were letters that I wrote to my nephew and two of my brothers that were in the military also wrote to my nephew. So we would just write letters home, yeah, telling people how we were doing.
And would they all write you back?
They'd write back, sure. When I was in boot camp, everybody would get a care package from home.
Yeah.
They'd get cookies, you know, chocolate chip cookies, get these kinds of cookies. So my mom and everyone in my boot camp class loved it. She was sending sticks of pepperoni. Something completely different. Here's a treat, a stick
That's
of pepperoni.
So her.
You know, so we would take chunks of the pepperoni and pass it around, and everybody would get, you know, some pepperoni.
Aww.
Something different.
That's
so
cool. You still buy those sticks at the farmer's market?
Yeah, once in a while.
Nostalgic.
Once in a while, yeah.
So I just wanted to, was that the last stop before you went to the submarine?
No, when I was in Saratoga, that was, another 6 months. I got there in December time frame, and we were all graduating around May, June. But I had applied when I was down in Orlando for the ROTC program to become an officer. And when I was up in Saratoga Springs, I was informed that I was accepted into the program, and I had my choice when I graduated from the nuclear power program, I had my choice. I could go to the University of California in Berkeley or Penn State as part of the ROTC programs, or be deployed on a submarine out of Bremerton, Washington. And I thought, if I go to Penn State, I'm close to home. So I chose Penn State, and I went to Penn State then for 2 years. But at the beginning of my junior year, I had to sign a new contract for the Navy that if I completed my degree, then I would owe the Navy another 4 or 5 years as an officer. And I had met my future wife at Penn State and didn't really see us being a military family. So I opted out. So I left Penn State that year. And that's when they assigned me to the submarine.
You were with mom while you were on the submarine?
Yes.
Why is my timeline so skewed?
I don't know.
That's crazy. So you were there 2 years, had already met mom, and then went to the other side of the country.
No, not to the other side of the country. The submarine I was on was out of Groton, Connecticut.
Oh.
New London. So,
I thought you said Washington.
Well, that would have been before I started Penn State.
Oh.
So when I left Penn State, I got assigned to a submarine because I was already on the East Coast.
Okay.
And I only had about 15 months left to serve in the Navy. They had an opening for someone of my specialty in Connecticut. So I got assigned to a fast attack submarine, the USS City of Corpus Christi, which was a Los Angeles class attack submarine. So I got assigned there, got there in January of 83 and was discharged from the Navy in February of 84.
So you only had to be on the submarine for a year.
13 months, yes.
And you lived on the submarine for all 13 months.
I was assigned to the submarine for 13 months. When we were in port, we had dorm rooms that we stayed in on the Navy base. So we had a room there. Like we were in the shipyard one time for 3 months. So we lived in the dorms, but we had to drive down to the shipyard every day and work on the submarine.
What was the longest you were ever actually on the submarine underwater?
11 days. 11 straight days.
Was that mentally tough?
Again, I always joke with people and say, no, I actually had more room on the submarine to move around and to sleep and storage for my clothes and everything than I did when I was a kid.
You're
at
like,
home.
I've been training for this my whole life.
Yeah. Yeah. With, you know, sleeping in a one room, you know, with four kids in it. I had more room on the submarine than I did, you know, in the bedroom back home.
But you weren't seeing the sun.
To me, I just never really thought about it. It was one of those things that there were guys that would go stir crazy. We had one guy that, you know, you could see after about a week, he started to, you know, change his mental attitude, stop shaving and things like that, you know, and I just never really thought about it. It just seemed...
What if there was a medical emergency?
If there would have been a medical emergency that you needed to get off, they would have come up and made contact and got you off and got you to what you needed.
How far down were you?
See, there's something that we're not allowed to say.
What?
So the military, you can say... And there's a book called Jane's Fighting Ships. They had what they called test depth and crush depth. So the military knew that once you went to a certain depth, then you risked the submarine
imploding
as we all know what happens when you go down too far and mm-hmm. it's not structurally sound. So they had what they call a test depth that you went as deep as that and that was it. So people would ask you questions like, how deep were you? And you go, well, you know, yeah, we were out there, but you know, you don't really say how deep you go or, you know, how fast you go. But there's a book called Jane's Fighting Ships that has some really good information in it.
Yeah.
So if you read that,
yeah,
you can sort of gauge, you know, what happened.
Would you guys, I'm just thinking of the times, like it was the 80s. What, as far as like masculinity goes, would it be normal to talk about like where you're at mentally or emotionally, or would everyone try and kind of like be tough?
Yeah, on the submarine, no one really talks about that. It's more just, you know, hiding your mental state as much as you can. You know, if you were freaking out, you really didn't try to go to somebody and talk to them about it. Again, I only witnessed it in like one or two people, and you could see it, and you know, you might say something to them, you know, and try to bring them out of it, just, you know, with joking with them and things, but you didn't really get into, just like guys do, you didn't really get into serious heart-to-heart conversations.
Yeah.
When we were off duty, you know, we'd watch, back when there were videotapes, we'd watch movies. One of our favorites was a movie with Chevy Chase called Modern Problems and Dabney Coleman. You know, we'd all say lines from the movie, you know, and when we'd be back in the engine room working, if somebody was, you know, having an off day or something, yeah, maybe you'd throw a movie quote out to them, you know, and they'd look at you and you'd have a little smile on your face and they'd perk up a little, you know.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, you know, the heart-to-heart, you know, talk about your mental capacity.
Yeah. But obviously when you're on the submarine, you're not getting mail.
Correct. You're not getting anything.
And I didn't realize at that point, so you had only known Mom for 2 years before you basically like planned that decision because you knew that you wanted to start a family with her and be with her.
Yes. Yeah.
And you had only known her for 2 years.
Yep. Just about 2 years.
And you just knew.
Yep.
I love that. Yeah. That's so sweet. How long did you go without seeing her?
Sometimes it was months on end.
Wow.
You know, when I'd be up there, you didn't always get time off, enough time off to travel that far. You know, I don't know. During that year, maybe I saw her 3 or 4 times. Now, that was also while I was on a submarine. That was 1983. That's when my younger brother was killed in a plane crash. So luckily we were in port, that I was available, that I could come home for the funeral and everything. But that was in May. But I don't know, you know, June, July, August, there were a couple months where, you know, didn't see.
Mom went with you.
To the funeral.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long did they give you to come home?
I think I was off for like a week or 10 days or something.
That's nice.
You know, because he was in the Air Force when it happened. So it was a military funeral as well. So they were very understanding. And like I said, we were in port. We were in the shipyard. So it's not like we were deploying to sea at any point in time around then. So they were very generous with allowing me to stay home.
The ship that you were on, does it still exist?
No. It is decommissioned. In fact, the conning tower is now a statue memorial in the city of Corpus Christi.
Have you seen it?
I've seen it online, but not. I haven't been there. When I was on the submarine, we actually went to Corpus Christi, Texas, and the people of Corpus Christi were like enamored with us. They were overjoyed. They held a lottery for people to win tickets to come for a tour of the submarine.
Wow.
So while we were there, we couldn't spend a dime. We went out and people were buying us drinks. People were inviting us to their homes for dinners. They were having parties, picnics, and, you know, they were inviting all their friends, and they'd invite 10 to 20 of us from the boat and, you know, just have us there as guests, you know, to talk to us and show us a good time in the city of Corpus Christi.
That's cool. When you actually went underwater, were you on a mission or was it just like, were you traveling? Are you allowed to say?
Oh, we were going places. So the purpose of a fast attack submarine is to go out. It's a submarine hunter or a ship hunter, what we like to call targets. We always say when you're out, on the ocean, you want to be in a target or on a boat. A submarine is a boat. If you're 1,000 feet below the surface of the water, you want to be on a target or on a boat. So you don't want to be on a surface ship that got destroyed by a
right.
submarine. But our goal was to go out and hide and find other submarines and track them, or just, you know, get lost so that no one could track us, so that in time of a war,
you know,
we could, if there was someone in front of us that we were tracking, then we could eliminate that target without them ever knowing that we were there.
Wow.
So we were just cruising the Atlantic Ocean, and the captain and the navigators knew where we were supposed to go. You know, I'm sure that every submarine that was in the Atlantic had a grid that they were covering. So you just, you know, went to different areas and just went around. Now, when I was there, we actually went to Fort Lauderdale for a few days. And then we went to Puerto Rico, and then we went to St. Croix. And then from St. Croix, we went to Corpus Christi.
It's hard to imagine a port where a submarine can, like, emerge. Do you have to get into port before you...
No. Going in and out of New London, Connecticut, Groton, Connecticut, you actually, it's a river. So you're on the surface until you get out far enough, and then you submerge.
Okay.
So as you're coming into the different ports, you're coming to the surface out to sea, you know, a few miles, and then you come in. That way you can see the other traffic that's there, and they can see you.
Okay.
Because if you're coming in underwater, you don't know when you're coming up, if there's something above you that you're going to run into.
Does the Navy itself build the submarines?
I know it at in Connecticut, it's General Dynamics is the company that the Navy contracts to build the submarines.
Wow.
But you are there working alongside the shipbuilders. As the ship is getting built, the crew is assigned to that ship or submarine. And then you are actually working there while the vessel is being built. My brother Gene was down in Newport News, Virginia. They were building a ship down there. That was his assignment when he was a machinist mate in the nuclear power program. So he was on new construction as well, and they were building a surface ship. So he was assigned to that.
Dad, it's so cool. I feel like I could ask you 1,000 more questions. I feel like I learned so much about you just now. Like, I always am like, yeah, my dad was on a submarine, and, you know, I have like my whole shtick, but thank you for sharing all that.
Oh, you're welcome.
I have so many other questions for you. So let's finish this section really quick. How do you think the Navy changed you?
I think it just gave me a little more discipline. You know, I was, like I said, when I graduated high school, I was a little immature. I was one of the goofy kids in the class, you know, always goofing around with doing stuff. And the military gave me a little more discipline, and it gave me the, you know, when you go to work, you don't always like what your boss wants you to do. But in the military, you learn to follow orders. So it's like, okay, you don't always understand why you're doing what you're doing. And sometimes when you're working for a company, the boss may understand, you know, why he wants you to do something. You may not understand it, and that's why you don't like it. But, you know, in the long run, you sort of figure it out. And that's where when I became a boss, I learned, well, I knew from the military to communicate better about why we're doing things.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that the military always used to teach you. Here's a job to do, but this is why you're doing this job and why it's so important to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when you become a boss somewhere, you don't just give people tasks to do. You explain to them the big picture of that task, where it fits into the company and why you're doing it.
Yeah.
And how it's good for everyone.
Do you think if you would have opted to stay or to extend your contract, that you would have like really rose in the Navy?
It's difficult. The military only promotes so many people. It's not like when you go to work at a job that if you prove yourself, you can go to your boss and their bosses and show them all the good stuff that you've been doing and why you deserve a promotion. In the military, they only take so many promotions per year. So it's really the best of the best of the best get promoted. So you could be doing a really good job in your area, but maybe you're in the top 20%, but they only take the top 10%. So I probably could have lasted for 20 years.
Wow.
And then, you know, after 20 years, you get a pension from the military. If you stay longer, every year longer you stay, you get a higher pension. But most people, if you make it 20, you know, then you can retire at any time. And
do you ever let yourself think that way, or do you just kind of?
No, every once in a while I think about it, but I'm like, well, you know, I would have been 37, 38 when I, you know, after 20 years. But then I think,
wow.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you could have retired at 37.
Well, I could have retired from the military at 38, but I would have had to get another job because the pension wouldn't have been able to, I wouldn't have been able to live off of that forever.
Okay. Got it.
You know, but, you know, it would have been nice now, you know, now that I am fully retired, that a military pension with your Social Security would be great. But it's also a burden on, you know, being away from your friends and family mm-hmm. when you're out to sea, for, you know, especially in the Navy. If you're on a ship, sometimes you're out to sea for 6 to 9 months, you know, and that takes a toll on a family.
Yeah.
So it's, you make different choices. It's, you need to have the family that really wants to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we came back from deployments, and houses would be empty. The spouse would be gone. There'd be a Dear John letter and like, oh, hey, God. I'm done. You know, I can't do this. So those are the things that, you know, you see that happening. You're like, well, I think if I would have stayed in the Navy for 20 years, I probably wouldn't have been married.
Yeah.
You know.
And you always knew you wanted to have a family of your own?
Yep. Yeah.
So what was it like becoming a dad for the first time? I know the second time was better, but.
Well, like they say, you're never, everybody says, well, I'll wait until, you know, I have the money or, you know, I'm prepared. Well, you never have enough money. You're never prepared to have a child. There's no training manuals. Everybody can tell you, oh, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. But every child is different. And you just learn as you go. It's just, but my father probably put it best when he came to the hospital to see Zach when he was born. And my father wasn't a very religious person, but he looked at me and said, how can you not believe in a God when you see a baby being born and, you know, this little infant like this?
Yeah.
He goes, it truly is a miracle.
Yeah.
So you just, you know, it's unbridled love. It's just unconditional love. You know, and that's what it is.
Well, you definitely gave that to us. What was something that was really important for you to instill in your kids?
The same thing my dad showed me. You know, everybody, let people prove to you, you know, what they are, whether they're good or bad. And for you to just be, you know, true to yourself and to be a good person and to respect other people, you know.
Was there anything from your childhood that you were like, I really want my kids to have that?
Maybe a sense of exploration. You know, I traveled the country twice with my mom and dad and my two youngest brothers by car. We had a pop-up camper one time. And the first time we traveled cross country, it was my older brother, Eddie, had a Volkswagen camper van. And my dad borrowed it from him. And the five of us jumped in there and traveled around the country and seeing different things.
What do you mean the five of us? You, Eddie?
No, my mom and dad, me and Tony and Brian.
Oh, nice.
So it was me and the three youngest. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, with you guys, we had a motorhome. Mm-hmm. So we tried to do the same thing, show you different things and, you know, take you camping and take you different places and give you that sense of exploration that, you know, learn things and see things. You know, don't have just a neighborhood mentality of, oh, this is where I live and this is what the world is like. You know, just get out there and see different things.
Yeah. Well, you definitely did that for us. What is the biggest difference between being a dad and being a grandfather?
The discipline. There's not as much discipline. I mean, we don't let the kids run rampant, but, you know, everyone always says it. I said it to my dad when the way he treated you and Zach, and Zach says it to us. You know, we laugh all the time that, yeah, we would never give our kids that much candy or that much cereal, but oh yeah, we give it to the grandkids, you know. Yeah, it's just different. One of the jokes I would tell people is, if I would known how great it is to be a grandparent, I would have skipped having kids and went straight to being a grandparent.
Yeah, it's such a hilarious joke.
Yeah.
Ha ha. I'm just kidding. Okay, and speaking of, how many years have you and Mom been married now?
Well, we got married in 1987.
Don't make me do math. Oh, so you're coming up on your 40th?
No, we're coming up on 39.
Okay.
39 this year. 40 next year.
What do you think is something that people misunderstand about long marriages? Like, what's a common misconception?
That it's easy. Mm-hmm. You know, any marriage you have to work at. People that get divorced, you know, it's because they have issues and, you know, we always think they just don't work at it enough. And sometimes it's inevitable. It just wasn't a good match to begin with. It was a mistake to even get married. But a long marriage, you just need to work at it. Mm-hmm. You know, something happens, you work together to resolve it. You know, you don't let things linger.
What's something that Mom has taught you?
What has she taught me that I didn't already know? My goodness.
Dad! Don't get yourself in trouble.
Maybe empathy.
Yeah.
Just to be a little softer, with everyone. You know, again, being in a large family, there were strict rules. I wouldn't say strict rules, but there was, you know, you didn't goof around too much because of, it could turn into chaos very easily. And then in the military, you know, also going through rules and everything. But just being a little softer with people and not, you know, always trying to force their hand.
You've become such a softie and I love it. I'm sorry. Does that embarrass you that I said that?
No, not at all.
Okay, good.
I admit it. I admit it.
I love it about you. Okay, so now that you're retired, what matters more that you have more time?
Well, it's just being able to spend more time with my friends, doing things I like, spending time with the kids, the grandkids, traveling more, you know, and not worrying about, you know, what's going on in the workplace, commuting to work and being on the road, you know, traveling for work, you know, all those things. Again, they all take a toll on your physical and mental well-being. You know, now it's just, okay, what are we doing today? You know, where are we going? Who are we going with? And just enjoying life much more.
Yeah. All right, last question. What does a good life mean to you?
I think a good life just means having a lot of friends, having a good time with everyone, having the respect of, you know, a lot of people and the people that you interact with. Yeah, I think it's not money, it's not things, it's just, you know, people. And having a lot of friends that you can just relate to and enjoy doing things with.
Well, I think you have a lot of friends because you're such a good person.
Well, thank you.
So thanks for doing this for me. Is there anything else I didn't ask you about? I'm sorry I had so many questions about the Navy.
It's okay.
That was so interesting.
Well, that is one experience.
Did you want to touch on like why it is that I'm your favorite child at all?
You are my favorite daughter. I admit that to everyone.
Cute. Well, Dad, this was really cool. Thanks for doing this for me. And I hope anyone who listened got a lesson on what it means to be a good man.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
A good person, a good dad, just all around. I love you.
Love you too.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.